Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Football is back, and it was a, well, in some ways, interesting weekend in the Premier League. The standout results, that scoreless draw in the Merseyside derby, a pretty forgettable affair. Arsenal beaten twice away from home in their opening two matches, and a real hammer blow against Brighton in the last minute. We saw Roy Keane in flying form as Manchester United drew 1-1 with Spurs on Friday night. And we had a double header yesterday live here on Off the Ball as Sheffield United's hopes of Champions League football suffered potentially a fatal blow, beaten 3-0 by Newcastle, while Chelsea reinforced their top four hopes with a 2-1 win at Aston Villa. Let's talk about it all with this guy. Pat Nevin, come on in. How are you?
I'm great. Those of you who have watched many things before will notice there's a different background.
Yeah. Football's back and you're at the football.
I am. I'm here at Manchester City, the Etihad, again for the second time this week. One of the 300 that will be in here. I feel like I should be in a movie, you know, the 300. You're very few of us are allowed in here. It's brilliant, though. I'm going to kind of almost getting used to it already. It's not the same. It doesn't feel quite the same. I mean, at this point in time, the build-up to the game, you can accept it, that it's a bit empty, but then it never fills up. It's dead weird, but it's back into it now. There's been good games, there's been bad games. You get that every week. And it's the teams that can cope with it best. That's the ones that are going to deal with it. And indeed, the broadcasters that can deal with it best as well, because I'm sure you know the feeling. You've done plenty of commentaries yourself, Nathan. It's different, isn't it?
Ah, yeah. Trying to generate excitement when the crowd aren't there to back you up. You can sound a little bit foolish at times, but here, it's better than where we were a week ago, that's for sure. So we'll take it. What is the match day experience like then? How different is it from where you were 3-4 months ago? Can you talk us through arriving at the ground and what processes you need to go through?
Oh, well, the last time I came here for the Arsenal game, it took me 45 minutes to get from my car to this seat. But that's 45 minutes. It's only 50 yards away. It's right. Much closer than the old car park. You're right inside the stadium now. So you're socially distancing the cars. That's the first thing. Then you get your temperature checked. Then you have to check all your badges. And then you go. There was 12 checks last week to get out earlier in the week to get in. It was only 8 today. So they're kind of smoothing it out a little bit. So you get in. So it's weird. It's kind of different in simple ways, right? So microphone, as you can see, that's my own one, which I've had to bring. You only have to bring your own. When I'm not talking, I've got a mask on. Everything. Here's the most unusual thing. You bring your own food and your own coffee and tea and stuff as well.
Well, this is a new normal that I can't get on board with at all, because the Etihad, legendary for the feast that it will put on.
You're absolutely right. There's certain places you go and you think, oh, give me that game. I mean, Arsenal's brilliant. Chelsea's fantastic for the food. But this place is brilliant as well. Nothing. Not even a cup of tea. Anyway, this is all a complaint. I know I'm so lucky to be in here. And to be fair, in reality, I watch football because I want to watch good football. I want to watch good football players. And when I watched the game last week here, Kevin De Bruyne was off the scale. He was absolutely fantastic. So I was buzzing after that game. And even after yesterday's games, there was ups and downs. I mean, if you're Evertonian, you're delighted by the fact they got a point. That was something they nearly sneaked to put. The 3 points at the end, you know, just very, very unlucky. Those hitting the post, and also nearly, it was Calvert-Lewin, I think, nearly got on the end of it as well with his little back flick. So, you know, good for them. But I was covering the Chelsea game as well. And the Chelsea game, that was extremely interesting to watch how Chelsea played and some of the decisions that Frank Lampard made. Considering, as you mentioned earlier in your build-up there, Sheffield United, Spurs couldn't win their games. Man United haven't been winning their games. You just go through them all. Arsenal fall. I mean, Arsenal blow Burnley. I mean, what? Really? Is that where it is now? So everything was waiting for Chelsea. They wanted to get that little bit of a jump because obviously they'll be playing against Manchester City in a few days' time. So it was a big, big win for Chelsea, and they deserved the win. But many times you watch Chelsea this year and they completely dominate the game and then get beat 1-0. Or they managed to find a way around it this time, and it was interesting to see some of Frank's decisions.
Yeah, go on, talk to us about them, because we're looking forward. We're doing commentary of Chelsea against Manchester City, and who knows, the way things work out, if Chelsea continue their good form, they may win Liverpool the title that night. The last game we did live from the ground here and off the ball was Chelsea's victory against Everton. And I remember in the build-up to that game, you're looking at the two teams and he was missing Kovacic, Kante, pretty much his entire first-choice midfield. Jorginho didn't play. And you were looking at the experience of Everton and thinking, Chelsea are going to really struggle here. And they blew Everton apart. So impressive. And again yesterday, you're talking about the tactical decisions. What did you do yesterday, Lampard?
A couple of big things. Jorginho's still not available, but Kante went and played in his central role again. You know, his initial role, sitting in the back of the three. Well, starting there, but basically playing everywhere. Mm. He was absolutely brilliant. Mason Mount, Ruben Loftus-Cheek finally getting back. Both of them were very, very good, but particularly Mason Mount was extremely good. And then you're Kovacic to the other side. And then you're looking at that bench they've got there and you're thinking, well, Billy Gilmore, he could walk into it as well. Jorginho's got to come back. They have got all sorts of options in that midfield. It's incredible. But a couple of things he made big decisions on. I think most people expected him to start with Tammy Abraham. He didn't. Stop with Olivier Giroud. Lots of raised eyebrows about that. Big call, but an even bigger call. He made a substitution and didn't take Giroud off. What happened? Giroud stays on and ends up scoring the winner. Who was the player he brought on? Pulisic. He comes on and scores. And you're thinking, well, it's not necessarily the way I'd have done it, but he did it and it worked out a treat. Now, sometimes managers have to get lucky, but he made so many good decisions, surprising decisions yesterday. Frank Lampard put Azpilicueta right back. It sounds like a small thing, right? But he's up against the main player. He's up against Grealish. Mm. Now, Reece James, no one done him this year. You think, why don't you just stick Reece James there? He crossed lots of balls. And so I thought that was a mistake at the start of the game. End of the game, hardly a kick Grealish got in the final third of the Chelsea half, and both goals were actually created by Azpilicueta, one from the right-hand side and one from the left-hand side, the byline. And what on earth Azpilicueta is doing there as a right-back in open play on the left wing, it tells you something about Chelsea. They're good fun to watch.
Yeah, they're good to watch, aren't they? They are that stage, surprisingly for Chelsea, considering what's gone on over the last 15 years. They're a lot of people's second-favourite team right now because there's so many exciting young players. You touched on quite a few of them there, but talk a bit more about Mason Mount, because every time you watch him, you're more and more impressed. And what's his best position? Where do you see him fully ending up when Chelsea, say, next season, they've made all their signings, the likes of Ziyech have come in, the likes of Werner come in. Where does Mason Mount fit into that side? How do you get the very best out of him?
Well, if you're playing, which he generally plays a 4-3-3, he'd rather be left of the three. He likes to play a lot of the time as the front of a diamond, almost as a 10. Mm. But name me any player who doesn't like playing there. Chelsea have eight players that want to play there, and so have most teams anyway. I think the thing is his adaptability. That's it. You can play him further forward as a left, not exactly winger, but left attacker. He's great at arriving in the box. He can play that left midfield role. He's perfectly comfortable. I've watched him play once as a sitting midfield. He was fine there as well. So anywhere across the midfield, even right midfield. So you've got a player who's great quality wherever he goes. Funnily enough, the best game I've watched him, one of the best games I've watched him, he played right-hand side of the midfield. And he's only started there once. So there is no best position for him. And that's the joy of him. You know, wherever you need that, and it's not even a gap fill. Wherever you need a power, you'll stick him in there. But who knows what the best position or the most regular position for him is going to be. A lot of people have been talking about Ruben Loftus-Cheek coming back. Now, he's got a lot going for him, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, but he must look at all the players in front of him. Just sticking Ziyech on top of that as well. Chelsea have just got too many. Now, Pedro will lose at the end. He will leave at the end of the season. But I would have said to you 24 hours ago, so will Willian. Willian was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant for last parts of that game. His intelligence was superb as well. So, I mean, it's really quite exciting times at the moment for Chelsea. I mean, the last game, you talk about that game against Liverpool. They were superb against the top team. The last time they played against Manchester City, Chelsea had more possession than Manchester City. Mm. When have you ever said that against anyone? So I'm pretty excited, not just because I've got feelings for Chelsea, but the fact that I like watching good teams and good players that have got that, kind of that spirit of, right, okay, you attack us, we'll attack you. I mean, the last game I seen before, I went to see them play against Leicester. It was up at Leicester. It was 2-2 in the end. And honestly, it's as if Brendan Rodgers had met up with Frank Lampard before and said, right, we're not doing tactics today. We're just having a big 11 aside and having a go at it. And you know what? Sometimes you get a bit fed up with too much tactics. It was absolutely brilliant. So Chelsea at the moment, they're in that position, their fourth position. They deserve to be. They really deserve to be in that position. It's up to everyone else to catch them.
I was glad to hear you say there were good games and there were bad games over the weekend, like any other weekend, because it feels as though a lot of people maybe were drinking the Kool-Aid over the last few months and maybe listening to the government's, it's going to raise the morale of the nation, and suddenly every match was going to be this free-flowing, entertaining game. And it turns out, you know, Bournemouth against Crystal Palace quite often isn't a classic. It's just another game of football and it's all perfectly fine. So what were the games that stood out? What were the moments of the weekend that you could really take note, considering we are just back?
I mean, Newcastle's a big jump, obviously. A real surprise to get the three goals as well. There was little, it was beginning to show a little bit just before the break, and you thought, well, can they keep that going? But that's a serious lift for Newcastle, and that was a big one for them. But to be honest, I was here. By the way, in case anyone doesn't believe it, might as well have a look. We are here, honestly.
Pitch looks good.
Yeah, the pitch looks good. The other thing is, see that scene I'm showing you there? That was actually a wee bit more exciting than some of the games that we saw. And it's true, and it's just the way it is. But it was a couple of things. I mean, watching Arsenal now, particularly the game out here, now they were really lucky in some ways. They got some bad injuries, and that was a hard one for them to take. They've not got the deepest of squads anyway. Guendouzi's in big trouble as well after that. And you look at the job he's got to do now, and he would have been thinking, you know, before Arteta would have been thinking before the restart, right, I've got everyone back. Oh, this is brilliant. I've got Kieran Tierney back. I've got everyone. Well, let's see what we can do. Two games into it, you're about five players down and you're a mess. It's a shambles looking just now. And if, at the moment, the knives aren't out for him. He'll get, obviously, plenty of time, Arteta. You know, get a chance to shape that squad. At the moment, it looks as if it needs a massive amount of work. You're talking about the Spurs stuff and other teams are chasing for it. You're not thinking about Arsenal for certainly not top four. And top six, a massive push.
And like you could be here all night talking about the issues that he faces, both individually, but also just the mentality of the players at the club and how it feels like there's a free-for-all when it comes to a pylon on Arsenal. It's so rare you hear opposition players be really critical of other professional players. But we saw Troy Deeney last year questioning the mentality, and then Neil Maupay having a right old pop at them again as to what type of character was within that Arsenal dressing room. Hey, are those players right? When you look at that Arsenal group, is there a real weakness mentally there in that group of players?
There may well be. I mean, I've talked many times in news talk before. I've loved David Luiz over the years, but he was just so slack in the game that he played here. When he came on as substitute, it just wasn't up at all. I mean, he had the classic one. Dropped, comes on the sub, gives away a goal, gives away a penalty and gets sent off. I mean, that is better than the Holy Trinity. That's all four. So nobody can defend him in that. But he just looks slack. And you cannot do that in the Premier League. You have to be up for it. And, you know, Ozil not playing just now, we know the stories behind that. But looking at the players, you think, how many of them look like a group, look like a team, look like a unit all working together? And there's few. I'll tell you what, Guendouzi's all right. He's one of them. I'm not going to have any complaints about him for any limitations he's got as a player. I'd have him every week because at least he'll put it about and at least he cares. And I think they need a lot more players like that through the spine of the team. And I watched the game again out here against Manchester City. And I've watched players like Lacazette and Aubameyang to some degree. Do you know when they play, when they fancy it, they are unbelievable. But boy, they better fancy it. Because when they don't fancy it, they look as if they don't want to put in a 50-50. They're not going to take any chances, injure themselves with the team. And that's just not acceptable. Not at this level. You can maybe carry one player like that in the team. See if you get two, three, four throughout the team, which they have had already this season. You're going to get, people will, they'll call them out on it and they'll just say, you're not as hungry as us. You're not desperate as us. You're not going to fight the way we're going to fight. Now, Maupay, to be honest, it kind of hurts slightly to get behind him too much because he behaved not particularly well. There's nothing wrong with the challenge for the goalkeeper. That's fine. It was the other stuff, the sneaky stuff that he was doing and throwing himself about. So I've not got a lot of time for players that do that. But he's absolutely right. He'll fight. And so will the rest of them all fight. And that's the problem that Arsenal got just now. And it's kind of a problem they've had maybe for a wee while. You get the feeling it's a root and branch change that you've got to make there. It's not going to be easy.
One of the better games of the weekend was Friday night and the 1-1 draw between Spurs and Manchester United. And on the one hand, you had Roy Keane at half-time unloading and David De Gea and Harry Maguire. And then you had the second half and Paul Pogba's introduction and a huge amount of praise. And questions now as to just how far himself and Bruno Fernandes can bring United. Kenny Cunningham was on Saturday's show talking about just that. I might play it to you here, Pat.
So I jump in, yeah. Well, it's interesting. Well, the question that John poses there, what's his best position? It's an easy answer, to be honest. The position we saw him play last night when he came on the pitch as a number eight, alongside Fernandes with a holding midfielder sat behind. That's your classic V-shaped in midfield, and that's the best position for Pogba and Fernandes. Because if they play consistently in that position for Manchester United from the start of next season, you're looking at two midfield players will probably guarantee between 20 and 30 goals and probably the same in assists. And that's absolutely huge. That's as good as any pairing that you'll see in world football, and I'd include Liverpool on that. Liverpool couldn't compete with midfielders of that quality.
So that's Kenny Cunningham talking on Saturday's Off the Ball there about Paul Pogba and Bruno Fernandes. In one sense, I guess, Pat, it's obvious you put two really talented footballers together and things are going to get better for Manchester United. Can they get that good the way Kenny's talking, that they could potentially contend next season?
You know what, listening to what Kenny said there made absolute sense, and you know, you see the two of them together. There was probably one word that Kenny used more than any word there. It's the word if. He kept on saying if. And if. That's the problem, isn't it? It's if. You know, if Paul Pogba decides to go and do it every single week, you know, then it'll work. You know it'll work. They are good enough. Physique-wise, they are fantastic. Technically, as footballers, they are right up there at the top. Right up there at the top. And I see what he says about even look at them, Liverpool midfield. Yes, they are technically better players. Those two. So yes, they could do that if. And it's just too big an if just now. When they do it for not just one game or two or three games or a part of a game, when they do it for half a season together and it looks like that, you start thinking, wow, right, now you're going places. But it has to fall into place. And somehow you have to make sure that Pogba stays fit, motivated to stay at Manchester United, and feels as if, you know, he can be part of the team as well. And it's not all about Paul. It's all about the team. It's all about the group. It's all about that club a couple of miles along the road from here just now. You need to make sure that's who you are. You're the big part of this team. You're the heart and soul of the team, not what the team can do for you. And do that. And I don't think there's any of us that don't believe that Paul Pogba could be world-class and could take Manchester United to all sorts of heights.
Bruno Fernandes does seem to have that consistency, and I know when he signed from Sporting Lisbon, he was sort of a one-man team there, and he did a little bit of everything, and he could pop up taking it off the keeper, and he could pop up playing in the number 10 role, and he'd score a huge amount of goals. And when he arrived, I think a lot of United supporters were wondering where he would play. Is he at the top of a diamond? Is that his role in this team, or could he play a little bit deeper, or what's...
See, it's a good question, but again, we do get uptight about the special roles. You know, really good players can play three different positions. Play them all really well, and everybody wants to be at the top of the dance. Every Paul Pogba would like to be there. That's what they all want. It's the easiest position in the field in some ways. You do the least amount of work, the ball comes through you, you get lots and lots of possession, and that's fine. But you can't have 10 players all playing there. So, you know, if you get there and you find yourself in that position, that's absolutely fine. But anywhere where you can manipulate it, they can work together. And if you look at it and you close your eyes and you think them two, you stick Matic or, you know, McTominay, and the physical ability you've got there, you think that's hard to play against, and the willingness of the likes of McTominay or Matic when he's fully fit to do that, you think that's kind of scary. That is really, really scary. But you would want Pogba to be like, nobody ever said to in years gone by to Brian Robson or Roy Keane, oh, by you play in one position. Roy Keane was everywhere. He was everywhere on the pitch. I can remember a classic one playing against Brian Robson once. He had nearly scored a goal at the back post with header, right? Our keeper caught it, threw it out to me in the ring, right wing. I took it back by the Man United left back, and Brian Robson tackled me. Where the hell did you come from? You were 60 yards away two seconds ago. And that's exactly what you want Pogba to be able to do. Because you know what? He's got it. He's got it and let me do that. But it's the willingness to do that. So yes, talk about a position, but they'd be absolutely perfect. I'm happy with Paul Pogba as the 8, as the 6, as the 10. Any of them, he's capable of doing it. What's the best way? Rotation. When you go there, if you find yourself in there, your mate goes there for you. And to be fair, to take it back to Chelsea, That's what Chelsea are doing just now. That's what they're really good at just now. I mentioned to you Aspilicueta, left wing. He just walked in the right back position. Intelligent players know what to do, help their mates out. That's what Pogba has to be. Help your mates out. And Bruno will be fine. He's got that about him. It's not an if with him. He's a stick on. So it actually is absolutely perfectly. But what you need to do is see when it's not your day, you help your mate, you stick in his position. It sounds really, really simple. Really good players do it all the time.
Have you ever seen that from Pogba? When we go back to World Cup and people talk about the Paul Pogba there, was he doing that? Was he helping his mates out in that France team? Or were they helping him out and letting him away with things a bit more?
No, it's the latter, I'm afraid. It was.
Because Kante was there.
Correct, Kante. Words out of my mouth. And it's not, I keep on bringing back Chelsea, but it was Kante for France that was doing it. He was everywhere. So anytime you see a gap and he leaves it, see for somebody covering it all the time, you're left to be free and then you don't have to hammer back all the time. So, you know, it kind of would almost make you a little bit lazy. Now, great, great players sometimes think, I don't need to do that. You know, I can swan about because when the ball comes to me, I'll cause enough damage. The thing is, when you get to the top level and you want to get, you know, to win leagues and all that, there's certain teams you can't do that against. You need all 11 of you all doing the same job. And that's, it sounds heavy criticism. It really does. It's not quite Keno criticism, but it sounds heavy criticism. You know what? Only criticise good players because the other ones kind of help it. Mm. Pogba, you're just saying, come on, do it. We want you to do it. We want you to see it. The capabilities you've got. And we'll be spoiled in this league. You know, from Yaya Toure to Patrick Vieira to Keno to, you know, those sorts of players. That's the standard. That's where we want to gauge you by, Paul Pogba. And do you know why we want to gauge you at that level? It's because that's where you think you are. And that's what you tell everybody you are. Well, you know what? We'll gauge you by that. You're not there yet. And you've not been doing that as often as those guys did. When you do it, we'll be there applauding you for doing it. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. I mean, there's a backhanded compliment in there if you dig deep enough.
Mm. Somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere.
Just to finish up then on tonight's game, Manchester City against Burnley, and listen, the way City performed against Arsenal and the bench that they had in terms of rotation, I don't think there's ever been a more talented substitutes bench than we ever saw what Manchester City had against Arsenal. From a Burnley point of view, it's the first time we've seen them back. Probably unusual in that they're one of the teams that generally seem to go with a 4-4-2 formation. Have they enough about them that can cause City some problems?
Yeah, probably not. Not, it depends on what Man City does. It doesn't actually depend on what Burnley do. Now, to be honest, it's interesting you mentioned the 4-4-2. I think it's only once this season, from memory, they didn't play 4-4-2. They played 4-3-2-1 when Man City came to Burnley. And they got thumped 4-1. So he actually tried to make a change for that game, and that was at home. But he still got thumped 4-1. So it's hard for Sean Dyche. It's one of those ones he just probably hopes that they have a quieter day. And if they have a quieter day, then you know, the work rate that they'll put in and the effort that they'll put in might have an effect. But if Kevin De Bruyne plays the way he played last time out here, nobody's going to stop him. He was off the scale. Don't know who they'll play tonight. It's one of those classic ones, you know, who they're going to play tonight. Will it be David Silva? Will it be Bernardo Silva? Will it be Mahrez? Will it be Sterling?
Maybe give your man Aguero a run out?
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't it really matter? Kind of what's the matter? We're sitting here and just in front of the show again. See the seats you can just see in front of us here? The ones right in front. Ignore Conor McNamara there. See the seats just in front of us. That's where Rodri was sitting. So he was substituting. Rodri's a top quality player. They moved him right up the back here, right beside us. And that's the kind of weird thing. They have got unbelievable quality all over the place. And someone asked me today, earlier on today, what about Sané? Will they miss him? Mm. Will they replace him? Will there be a big miss? And I'm thinking, no, they probably ought to get a defender. Don't worry about too many more attackers and great players. You've got plenty there. There's millions there.
You obviously got a good view of Rodri. I mentioned during our commentary of the game on Wednesday night that he was looking a little bit bigger than he was maybe pre. Maybe that was something planned, that they wanted to bulk him up a little bit. Is he a bit bulkier than he was 3 months ago?
You know, I'm kind of wary of saying this because some players come back and you think, oh, I wonder. You think in a modern game, surely they wouldn't come back a wee bit. A bit of timber there, you know. You imagine it couldn't happen. I watched the game yesterday. I love John McGinn, right? I adore him. Being a Hibs fan and watching him come through, it was absolutely brilliant. And I thought he could play with any level of team down here. But he's up and down that pitch and he's everywhere and he's tall and gangly. And I watched him yesterday and I thought, hey, that's John McGinn. It's a bit more of John McGinn. And this is a guy who I consider a friend because I talked to him quite a few times as well. So maybe one or two come back. And shall we be kind and say at the moment that they've tried to bulk up?
Yeah, well, let's go with that. Yeah, you're in a position to criticise. I'm not, so.
Yeah, well, I was out running this morning. I'm feeling all right, but not quite that level. But he looked all right when he was getting about the pitch. In the end, if you bulk up, get around the pitch, that's fine. Doesn't matter what you win.
All right, Pat, great stuff. Enjoy the game.
Take care then. Bye-bye.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. The greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Bad day for the Irish as Sheffield United were beaten 3-0 by Newcastle United, and then we had Chelsea's victory as well over Aston Villa. More games coming this week. On Wednesday night, we'll be at Anfield for Liverpool against Crystal Palace with myself and Brian Kerr. And then on Thursday, we've got Chelsea against Manchester City. I'll be alongside Stephen Kelly for that one. It looks as though City are going to make it 2 wins from 2 after the restart. They lead Burnley by 3-0 with the second half just about to get underway. But that match may be potentially overshadowed by a banner that was flown over the Etihad Stadium during the game saying "White Lives Matter Burnley." So that banner flown by a plane over the stadium a couple of times during the match. We'll talk about that with Dan McDonald. He's coming up in just a little while. But going back to yesterday, that first game then, well, John Egan sent off and Enda Stevens with an absolute howler for the first goal. I was alongside Brian Kerr on commentary. I put it to him that it was a particularly bad day for Sheffield United's Irish contingent.
Yeah, McGoldrick didn't make the squad. He obviously wasn't fit after the knock he got coming on sub the other night against Aston Villa. And then it didn't go well for John Egan. Obviously, the yellow card in the first half, it might have been a little bit harsh. It was a nothing incident. It wasn't like it was a foul or a kick. It was a row over a free kick that was awarded to Sheffield United. And he got involved with Joe Linton. The referee decided to give both of them yellow cards, but that was costly for him. In the second half, went up against Joe Linton. He probably got a little bit too tight to him. We probably need to hear what Damien Delaney or Gary Breen, the centre-half's union, have to say about it. But initially, he was right up against some long boot forward from Newcastle player there with a penalty here. He got the first touch with his right leg around Joe Linton's body, but the ball broke off Joe Linton's body into his path, and it looked like he was going to get away from John Egan, but he held him, and he held him probably too often. He had a couple of snatches at him, and the referee decided that he did foul him, and that proved to be crucial in the game, because then the Stevens made a bad error from Matt Ritchie's attempted pass that Enda Stevens tried to cut it out, and it went between his legs as he tried to kick it with his right foot into the path of the pass went into the path of Sam Maximan. He scored, and the opening goal was crucial in this game for two teams that don't score a lot of goals. Newcastle 25 before today, and Sheffield United just 30. So the opening goal was very important, and obviously with the 10 men, Newcastle went on from there to win 3-0.
Sheffield United could have gone fifth with a win. They now go to Old Trafford to play Manchester United on Wednesday. That's a huge game for them if they are to somehow squeeze into a Champions League place. They've been the story. Newcastle often get forgotten about in the way they're nicely in mid-table now, but they got their goals, and three attacking players got their goals for once. Joe Linton, first in quite a while, first at St James's Park for him in the Premier League. Steve Bruce getting enough credit?
Probably not. You know, he's got a lot of criticism, I think, from Newcastle fans who are probably over-expectant. They don't always realise how ordinary many of their players are. And I think Steve Bruce has extracted almost the maximum from them. I'm not sure that Joe Linton was his choice. It was a lot of money spent on him, 40 million. Sam Maximum, they're getting good value from him. Another goal today, that's 3. It took him a while to get going. Didn't score until December, I think, was his first goal. Joe Linton's last goal was it, we saw it against Spurs in early in the season, September maybe, was it?
August, I think, yeah.
Was it? They won 1-0 away at Spurs. And so he gets a goal there. But his all-round game today, I thought, was quite good. And the three of them together, Almiron played well. Matt Ritchie got a good goal, good finish, good strike. But Sheffield United were off today. Newcastle were better. 38 points, that will be safe. I think 37 has been enough for the majority of the last 10 seasons. So 38 will be enough for them this season to see them safe. And so now they can be looking, can we get a little bit further up the table rather than looking down? A good few seasons it's been looking down, looking behind for them. Are we going to be safe? So I think Steve Bruce done a good job.
A lot of people have watched a lot of football this weekend. Every suddenly, match suddenly. On the television, and of course tuning in on Off the Ball on the radio, I'm sure. Taking a break on the... Just tune in on the app and you can...
Go for a drive.
Exactly,
and
exactly.
To
that's it. It keeps everybody happy is the only thing we could advise. From what I know from talking to you around it, you haven't overly enjoyed the behind closed doors experience. Just in terms of performances, though, what stood out over the weekend?
Well, I think Newcastle's result has been a bit of a standout. I think Arsenal's two defeats are quite shocking, even by Arsenal standards. The fact that they blew the new Brighton match, haven't gone ahead. I suppose Wolves coming back, you know, but finding a way to win that game, get two goals when it looked like it was petering out into nothing against West Ham, just confirms their season so far that it's not a flash in the pan.
Who wins a 100-metre sprint between Adama Traore and Alan Saint-Maximin?
Well, I think Traore's been doing it for a lot longer. I mean, I can remember him playing with Middlesbrough a few years back, playing in the front position and running like, you know, running like a very fast hare, but not running in any great direction, running like a hare that was trying to avoid the hounds. But now there seems to be a lot more logic to what he does when he's on the ball, a lot more effectiveness, and he is really a key player for them. Come on and change the game yesterday. But some good performances, but some very mediocre performances so far, and I think the players will need a game or two to get back into the rhythm of their combination players, of their understanding between each other and the best of their touch.
What about Friday night, Manchester United against Tottenham? There's obviously a huge amount of criticism from Roy Keane in particular for Harry Maguire and David De Gea for the first goal, but then a lot of praise for what Paul Pogba did in the second half and just how good that combination of himself and Bruno Fernandes could be, with Kenny Cunningham on yesterday saying he thinks that those two as a midfield could potentially spark United into being real title challengers next season.
Well, I think that was the best match of the weekend in terms of technical ability, tactical play, change of fortunes, Spurs getting a goal, looking dangerous on the break, Manchester United dominating possession, missing a couple of opportunities, but finding it hard to break through, and Spurs sat back in the second half, having got the lead goal. They probably sat back too far. Pogba come on and had an impact, just as you talked about Traore there, had a real impact in the game, seemed to be a spark already. And I heard Bruno Fernandes talking after the match about that they've hit it off, they worked together in training, they've been in the same small walking group, he said, and that's clever by Solskjaer to do that, to ensure they're trying to develop an understanding. But isn't it sad that we're talking about Pogba, but he's not made an impact this season, that he's played so little, and all that controversy, is he injured, is he not injured, is it sore ankle, is he getting better, is he going to be back, is he going to be fit, is he going to leave? It's
hard to get carried away in half an hour.
Yeah, it is, but you know, he's a good player, Pogba. He's not consistent enough. He needs to do it for a long period, he needs to do it game after game, he needs to be a match winner more often. But Fernandes has showed he's a player, and he is a better player than what Manchester United have been using for the last couple of seasons in those attacking positions from midfield. He can see a pass, he can play a pass, and he can shoot. He's taken penalties. Most of his goals have been set pieces so far, but he's had a real impact since he's come along, and there's a lot of potential there in that pairing.
Another quiet weekend as well in the life of Roy Keane. He'd be swinging punches in the United dressing room at halftime, leaving the two lads behind around the bus home. Keith Andrews, the bullshitter.
Look, you know, Roy has been a manager and he knows what it's like. He's been a player. He knows what that's like. Now he's a pundit. And he's doing his punditry in his own way. I think it certainly gives headlines. But I didn't think his analysis at halftime was particularly incisive or logical. I mean, yes, Luke Shaw should have done a bit better in that moment And Maguire could have done a bit better. And certainly it was a mistake by De Gea. But it kind of overlooked how brilliant the play was by Bergwijn to come up with that. And also that over the period of time, Maguire has been a good player for Manchester United this season. Luke Shaw has had a fairly decent season also. And De Gea for years has been a very good goalkeeper for United. Is he overrated, as Roy says? I don't think he's overrated. I think he's let in some soft goals this season. And as we said in commentary today, he's going to be under pressure by Dean Henderson. But talking about, you know, throwing punches at half-time at the dressing room and so on, I don't think that does Roy any favours. It grabs a headline if the media want to use him for headlines and for sensationalism at half-time and after matches, so be it. But would it be attractive to clubs to take him on as a manager if they thought that's how he actually reacts at half-time to someone making mistakes? I don't think so. But, you know, look, at everyone has their own style. Everyone does it their own way. And, you know, Roy's way is a bit different.
Yeah. Well, you've been in the dressing room with him. Did you ever see him swinging punches, raising his voice? I understand that.
I was the manager. He was the player.
But even as a player...
No, we didn't have, you know, look, I was fortunate enough to manage Roy for a few matches with Ireland when he eventually came back, and his behaviour and outlook and influence was excellent, you know, around the team, in the training, on the pitch. I mean, he wasn't at his best at that time. He was still suffering from some of the previous injuries he's had, but he still had an impact. But it was only a short part in his career, and we got on very well. He got on very well with all the staff and all the players during that period, and, you know, he was a great servant of Ireland when he played in the matches. He had a great impact. He's one of our greatest ever players. And he's moved on now with his career. And, he, you know, having probably said he never wanted to be a pundit, he is a pundit, and he attracts a lot of attention. And he sees the game very clearly, and he sees the game very well too.
Yeah, you've done all right. You haven't got the tongue lashing just yet.
I haven't read the books. Maybe it's in there in the books.
I think you did okay. It was McAteer was the problem, wasn't that it?
With me?
Let's not go there again. We've already done that.
I never read any of them. It doesn't bother me at all.
That is Brian Kerr. I was talking to him after he was part of our commentary team yesterday on Newcastle's 3-0 win over Sheffield United. I'll be back alongside him on Wednesday for Liverpool against Crystal Palace, live commentary of that, and of Chelsea Manchester City on Thursday. City 4-0 up against Burnley, 10 minutes gone in the second half. David Silva has added a fourth. They were 3-0 up at half time, two from Riyad Mahrez, and the opening goal scored by Phil Foden. Dan McDonnell, the football correspondent at the Irish Independent, is with us as well this evening. Evening, Dan.
Evening, Nathan.
Couple of talking points coming out of this game, and one that's probably going to take all the headlines, is a plane that flew over the Etihad Stadium, which of course has no supporters inside, saying and having a banner at the back of the plane with "White Lives Matter Burnley," which is pretty shocking. The reports seem to be that the Burnley players, several of them, saw this flying overhead while the game was going on and were seen shaking their heads, understandably, in disgust. Burnley have come out very quickly. They've issued a statement, obviously distanced themselves from this completely. But it just raises so many questions as to how something like this can happen and how they can, how the airplane hire company in the first place even agrees to this.
Yeah, it does. It is going to overshadow the game, I think, purely because the game itself has developed into such... Well, no, not purely because, that's the wrong way of phrasing it. It's just a massive thing as it is. But like, the game is a non-event. This is an event. This is something that's bigger than football and is tied in with that. And as a consequence, you know, I suspect you're going to have, you know, Sean Pearl, Sean Dyche, and, you know, you know, is going to be in the middle of something afterwards that they, you know, they haven't asked for. They've moved quickly to condemn. But it's just, you know, it ties in. Like, I don't know. You know, do you miss England? Do you miss going to England at the moment, Nathan? I mean, obviously, you know, there's obviously, like, you know, it's a place that we lean on so heavily for so many reasons, particularly in football. I mean, you go there all the time. I go there pretty regularly. But it's I don't know, it's not a place you'd be missing very much at the moment. It's a pretty fraught time, and these stories are just very dispiriting and depressing. And look, it only takes a couple of people probably to do something like this, I guess. I mean, we've seen in the past, you know, groups of fans at a club, you know, commandeer, you know, a plane or whatever to send out a message. And you could say that Burnley are just really victims of their name being associated with what it is. But still, it's so public at a time when millions of people are watching all the Premier League games because of the fractured nature of the calendar. And I don't know, it's very deflating, really, isn't it? Mm. Like to be down this road again.
Well, considering there have been so much good stuff out of football around Black Lives Matter and all the players still wearing the on the back of their jerseys, the Black Lives Matter, I think this may be the final match before they go back to just having their names again. And again, before this match, all the players took the knee when the whistle was blown to start the match for 10 seconds. Now, you do wonder when you see that, the fact that it's the Etihad Stadium, it's Manchester City, and that Raheem Sterling has been such to the fore throughout all this, how pointed this was. But it brings humiliation, whether they want it or not, and embarrassment upon Burnley. And you're right, Sean Dyche, unfortunately, is going to have to come out and he suddenly has to try and explain this way when it's literally nothing to do with him.
Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, listen, I'm sure he will condemn it very strongly, and there's not much more he can do besides that. You know, it's like the name of Burnley is obviously damaged by this. I mean, you don't even know if it was Burnley spectators or fans, you know, who were responsible for this in any way. So, like, it's. You know, look, football has taken a very powerful stand in the last couple of days. I particularly found for the first game. I don't know why, just there was something particularly powerful about the first match, the Aston Villa Sheffield United and the blowing of the whistle and then going down. And, you know, you can head off into a whole side debate about where politics and sport overlap and when they should overlap. And I appreciate there's a range of views on that. But when you have someone like Raheem Sterling, you know, who's articulated his case so well, in that, you know, and a game that he's involved in, you should have this message, which is you know, pretty deplorable. I mean, it's not even, it's an extreme level of whataboutery. It's a bit more sinister than that, really. And it's something that, I mean, we can just go round and round saying it shouldn't happen, but it shouldn't happen, and we'll see what consequences there are from it.
The other story from a footballing point of view is, well, it's probably when you look at the two benches. Manchester City, I thought on Wednesday against Arsenal, probably the greatest bench talent-wise they've ever seen in the Premier League. And it's pretty similar tonight. They made 8 changes. They're just about to bring Kevin De Bruyne on for the last half an hour of the game. In contrast to Burnley's bench. So you're allowed to name 9 players on the bench. Burnley have only named 7, and 2 of those are goalkeepers. It's good news from an Irish point of view in one sense, that Jimmy Dunn, the young player from Louth, he could make his Premier League debut, whether he'll want to at this stage, a defender going on away at Manchester City and being 4-0 down. But Burnley have taken the decision, it seems, to not play any of their players who are out of contract next week, which includes Jeff Hendrick. So there's 4 of them. Phil Bardsley may well have started. Aaron Lennon would certainly be in the squad. Joe Hart probably wouldn't have played either way. Sean Dyche spoke about it ahead of the game, saying, well, basically a decision was made, it seems, either on the club's behalf or on the players' behalf, that they're not going to play because some of them haven't been offered new contracts, and it just seems very, very messy and leaves Burnley in a pretty precarious place, because Robbie Brady's among 4 or 5 players is out injured as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, like, the Hendrick situation is probably, from an Irish perspective, the most interesting. Like, Brady, as you mentioned, is out of contract, and seemingly, okay, there might be issues there with fitness. But, I mean, Burnley are taking an option on him by all accounts. But the Hendrick one, I mean, we do know, I know people sort of scoffed a bit initially, you know, when AC Milan was mentioned, but I'm certainly told that interest is legitimate. I think Roma was subsequently mentioned as well. And, like, Jeff Hendrick is in a very good position, that whatever our perception of Jeff Hendrick, in Ireland, obviously, he takes a fair bit of flack, you know, because he really, since Euro 2016, he hasn't lived up to the standards that he set for himself then, perhaps. And I know there would be a viewpoint that maybe he struggled, particularly with maybe tactically, you know, he was shunted around a bit under managers and maybe wasn't clear what his role should be. And we'll see how he gets on under a different type of manager maybe later this year. But leaving that to one side, Jeff Hendrick has played a lot of Premier League football in the last couple of seasons, and in a post-pandemic transfer market, where you think that there's going to be a big reduction in spending, a free agent player who's played a lot of Premier League games is a commodity. Mm. It doesn't come with a fee attached. So the cost of signing him is his wages. And that's basically it. You know, I assume a signing on fee, but the player's in a very good position. And, you know, Burnley want to keep him and they want him to stay. Hendrick is quite plausibly, you know, and rationally for me, he's taking time to see what happens, because you never know, depending on who goes up or goes down in the Premier League might determine his range of options. But clearly, from the Burnley side of things, or from the Hendrick side of things, we'll need to clarify, I guess, in the next day or two. The fact that he's not playing is surprising. I know there have been some talk about we've seen it with Ryan Fraser and other players. But this is a situation where Burnley want Hendrick to stay. So you would thought maybe this might be one where they would thrash something out. But the flip side is they're mid-table. They don't have very much to play for either.
Well, the other question is, does Jeff Hendrick want to play, considering Burnley are safe, they're mid-table, and you say he is in such a brilliant position to make a probably life-changing move here. Financially, he's going to be the beneficiary of this move. A good chunk of what would have been a transfer fee will go straight into his pocket. And are you going to go out and play and potentially put yourself at risk of injury? As harsh as it may sound, like, the sensible financial thing to do is to sit this one out.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to guess what happened. I think Sean Dyche is going to become clear in the next day or two. But I do agree with your standpoint there. And I think we've seen other examples in the Premier League and the Championship that it is complex for players. And it's not as if, you know, Hendrick, like the Ryan Fraser one, is difficult at Bournemouth, because I mean, they might go down. And is that going to linger on his reputation there if he could have helped them from that position? There's been a case with Charlton in Championship, one of their key players as well. I guess, as you say, you know, whatever happens, you know, Burnley's season isn't going to be determined by what happens with Jeff Hendrick in the next month. So maybe there's an element of pragmatism about this situation from all parties, but it's definitely one to watch.
I feel sad that Jeff Hendrick is leaving Robbie Brady. It just felt like I know Robbie Brady's married now, but I still like to think Jeff Hendrick lives with him, that he puts up with him, that, you know, he has a spare room where Jeff just stays over.
Listen, I do know that they like each other, so we can joke about it, but it would be terrible if it turned out years from now that they never liked each other at all. You know, and it goes back to their days at Kevin's.
Yeah, like, yeah, you know, but just because they were so brilliant, they got stuck together, going everywhere together.
Yeah, the door opens at Burnley, like, oh no, God, not this fella.
But I know
they actually do get on, but it is... it's strange. Like, you have these Irish colonies that come together at places, and I know Kevin Long and Jimmy Dunne are still there, but eventually they have to go their ways. I think Hendrick should explore the European option. I really do. I think if the option is there, I'd love to see him try it. It might actually suit him, but again, like, it's often very tempting. There's very good money in the Premier League, and there's a certain amount of people involved, but I'd love to see him try the Italian thing if the option is still very much there.
Any FAI news over the weekend? Any progress in the League of Ireland?
Yeah, like, it's. I feel like we're stuck in a cycle here that, you know, and I noticed just from my day-to-day work that we're sort of, we're crawling along. I do think football will be back now. I think really since last week, since the improved package was presented, and then you followed that on with the government announcement for sport on Friday, that removed really the element of doubt, I think, for me, really, about whether football will come back. It's more now in what format, and it's gone to a different stage of footballing arguments about how long should the season be, how should we solve relegation, promotion, you know, is it good enough to declare a champion after 18 games, etc. But it's moved on from beyond will we have football. I think we're going to have football now, which is good, but there's still work to do. And obviously, the FAI board, as far as I know, still have to process what Friday's announcement really means for their cash flow situation. There's a FIFA meeting this week. And of course, with that, there's like the FAI as well are also undergoing a pretty significant restructuring of their executive as well.
Yeah, can you talk about that? Because that, again, maybe it's a bit more nerdish and people don't understand or don't care what's going on at board level. But it does seem like it's a huge change in the way the FAI is run at a time coming just before they're about to appoint a new CEO, who you would think should be overseeing this.
Yeah, that's a view that's been offered. Like, if you're going to have a radical restructuring of your executive, your workforce, it's like your backroom staff as such, if you're the CEO, you would think they would like to have a say perhaps in, well, how, what type of team would we want and so on and so forth. So, yeah, they have created new roles, or more so creative new executive, and people have to apply internally. In some cases, they're applying for their old job. In others, it's a slightly tweaked version of their old job. They've been told they have until this Friday to apply. But you are right. Some questions have been asked in sort of football circles about, is this happening too quickly? Stephen Kenny's on the the executive now. What does that entail? And I've been trying to clarify this, and certainly the FEI aren't necessarily dealing with questions on the record as such directly at this point. But in due course, they're going to have to maybe tease out in detail what this actually entails.
Well, does it mean, and again, maybe nobody knows, that Stephen Kenny, even when the senior international job comes to an end, still has a role within Irish football as a sort of godfather type role, which would be in contrast, I guess, to every previous senior manager and every senior manager everywhere.
And listen, you want to be positive in terms of how you interpret things, but obviously if you jump to the negative interpretation of this, that if results aren't going well for the senior international team, that naturally impacts the other sides of the business in terms of commercial and other things. And if you have the senior team manager present in executive discussions, you would think there has the potential for some slight discomfort. But the flip side of that is, we've often complained that our senior manager is very detached from development of the game in Ireland and other, you know, just what we're doing generally. And we're going to have a different type of appointment here, someone who is in tune with that. But I take your point that I think people are going to have questions about just how this will actually function. Not least, maybe the new CEO will ask, maybe I've done things differently if it turns out that the new CEO isn't someone that's in or around the premises at the moment.
All right, good stuff, Dan. Thanks a lot for that.
Thanks very much,
McDonald, mate. There. And it is now Manchester City 5, Burnley 0, a second goal of the game for Phil Foden. 20 minutes left in that one, and it could get a whole lot worse for Burnley. Quick break, and then we're going to hear from Damien Delaney.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Manchester City going to be back within 20 points of Liverpool at the top of the Premier League table. They lead Burnley by 5-0 with a quarter of an hour left at the Etihad. 2 goals for Phil Foden, 2 for Riyad Mahrez, and City are cruising in that game. So we'll keep you up to date with that between now and 10 o'clock here on the Football Show. But first, let's hear from Damien Delaney. He was on co-commentary yesterday for Chelsea's 2-1 victory against Aston Villa. Here he is talking to Stephen Doyle.
Former Republic of Ireland international Damien Delaney, we've just been watching the action at Villa Park, 2-1 win for Chelsea. I suppose when we saw what happened in the first half, we were thinking, well, it's a Chelsea win all day. Do you think there was any doubt in their minds going into the dressing room once they conceded that goal to Aston Villa, or would they have been confident all along they would still see the game out and get the win?
I think managers like Frank Lampard set a game plan in place, and if his players can execute it, he knows that 99 times out of 100 they'll win the game. Now, even if they go behind, he won't panic, because if they go behind and the players aren't implementing what he wants, that means they're losing because things aren't going as he planned. But I thought that first half went exactly as he planned, apart from the goal. And he knows that on the law of averages, if they go out in the second half, he's been a part of enough Chelsea teams where they've won games late. He knows that if they keep asking the right questions, keep knocking away, eventually the rewards will come, because Villa can't hold out. Not when the possession is 75% and above. And I know you said at the start of the second half, it was up to 90-10 at one point. Nobody can withstand that. Eventually, the door's going to open.
Would you say that win now is enough for Chelsea to kind of think, this top four place is ours, we will be in the Champions League next season? They still have a bit more to do, do you think?
The thing I say is, who behind them is going to put a run together to catch them? So I'm not saying that they're home and hosed just yet, but I think that they've put themselves in a position where they can, even if they have a little spell where they draw two games, the ones behind them aren't winning, 7 out of 8 games. Man United aren't putting together a run like that. Spurs aren't, or Arsenal aren't putting a run together like that. I mean, maybe someone like a Crystal Palace or a Sheffield United or Wolverhampton is what you'd be worried about, because maybe they could, under the radar, put that type of a run together, but it'd be a surprise. So all Chelsea need to do now is maintenance. Just keep tipping away, keep adding the wins, keep getting a couple of draws. With a 5-point cushion, they have a little bit of wriggle room where if they do have a bad couple of results, they'll still be okay.
Big game for them on Thursday against Manchester City coming up. That one at Stamford Bridge. look, we know home form doesn't seem to hold any water when teams are playing behind closed doors. We've seen it in Germany. It seems to be happening in the Premier League as well. What are Chelsea hoping for from that game? Well, obviously 3 points, but against a really good Manchester City team, do you think they will beat them on Thursday night?
I think this Chelsea team are kind of in its infancy of doing something good. You know, they really have put a good plan in place. They've put a good transfer kind of system in place where they're buying young players. And although they lost to Bayern Munich, and they'll more than likely lose the second leg as well, and games like Manchester City, I think Frank Lampard will be using those as a learning curve for the future, so that, you know, his young players are used to playing in big games, used to come up against calibre of opposition of a Bayern Munich and a Manchester City and a Liverpool. So when they play against them afterwards, he can say that's a level we've got to get to, because they are out in front of us at the moment. So while he will be looking for 3 points, he'll also be thinking this is an invaluable experience for the likes of Mason Mount, you know, the likes of you know, Ruben Loftus-Cheek and Ross Barkley, you know, saying to these guys, look, this is the standard we got to get to, you know. And then with Timo Werner coming in next season, they're definitely on the road to getting there. So he will be looking for 3 points, but I think he won't be expecting a whole pile.
I'll go back to Timo Werner. You mentioned during the commentary about the FA Cup, and it's a really good chance for Lampard to get a trophy in his first season. Do you think he'll go all out to try and get that FA Cup win?
I think the Champions League will be a priority, but with the cushion he's given himself, I definitely think that he will now be looking for all guns out, going for the FA Cup, because again, it's part of the learning curve for these young guys that he's assembling, you know, with the like the Pulisic. Can they get to a cup final? And can they experience a cup final? Insofar as even if they win or lose it, you know, if they win, they could say, okay, we've got a trophy under our belt. If they lose it, they can say, okay, listen, you know, we still got a little bit to go and we still want to win cup competitions. So for these guys to play in games of that magnitude, the Manchester City's, Bayern Munich's, FA Cup finals, that's the kind of their next stepping stone, really.
You mentioned Timo Werner. He's coming in for a big price tag, just under 60 million. A lot of people wondered about the Roman Abramovich project. He's, you know, he's not around London these days, whether his heart was fully in the Chelsea setup, whether he might have been considering selling the club onto another club owner. But he seems to be putting money into the club again. He's investing in players. Timo Werner comes in at a big price tag. Which player in that Chelsea team is most worried about his position? Because you don't pay that amount of money for a player to sit on the bench.
No, he's going to come in and play, and it's pretty obvious who he's going to play. I think he's going to play up front, and maybe not a traditional number nine, but he's definitely going to play in probably looking at today's team, instead of Giroud as a number nine, or maybe Willian, you know, because Willian's getting on now, and I know he's a contract issue there as well, insofar as whether he's going to stay or not. So, but again, a player of that quality coming in is going to elevate Chelsea to another level again. With Abramovich, I think he's realised that he can't keep pouring money at the rate that he was in. They've got a strategy now, you know, and I know the Timo Werner money probably offset by the Morata money. So yeah. Has he really just put 60 million of his own? He's not. I think he's probably said years ago, I'm not doing this anymore. We can't just keep going out buying the top talent in the world, because, you know, although he's a very wealthy man, he's not, you know, state backed, which some teams are now. So he's realised that he can't compete in that end, where he can go and spend 200 million. Back in the early 2000s, he could just come in and spend 50 million, and nobody could do that back then. So he kind of changed the game. So they've realised this, and they've gone down a different route, you know, where we have to sell to generate money, and we're going to buy young players. And if we can sell on players at their peak and make 80, 90, 100 million off them, then we'll reinvest that in young players. And I think that was their strategy for a long time now. But look, Timo Werner is a fantastic player. He fits really well with what Chelsea are trying to do. And it's great to see a club with a really good transfer strategy.
Speaking of money and spending money, Aston Villa spent a lot of it at the start of this season. And if you spend that amount of money, you would expect to be staying in the Premier League. But we've seen it so many times, Damien, with teams coming up and blowing a load of money on players. I can't seem to fit those players into a steady kind of system where they get good results. So was a mistake by Villa now in hindsight? I know it's easy to make these assessments in hindsight, but when you look back, did they buy too many players? Did they spend too much money? Should they maybe have put more faith in the players that got them promoted?
Well, look, when we got promoted at Crystal Palace, we pretty much kept the nucleus of what we had. Mm. And we said, we're going to go at it with what we're good at, which is, you know, defensively strong, counter-attacking football. And these are our principles. We want to stick with it. Fulham tried it a couple of years ago. They went up and blew all this money. And I know the manager there said afterwards that they did that wrong. Even the club admitted we shouldn't have done that. We should have stuck with what we had. And I did catch you say at the start of the second half that Dean Smith spent 140 million, you know, And I was going to pull you up and say, well, did he really? Was it Dean Smith that spent it? I'd be surprised. You know, I could picture Dean Smith sitting in his office and, you know, one of these players walks in the door and he actually has to go, who's that? And that happens, believe it or not, in football, where like director of football goes, oh, that's Samata. He's our new centre forward. And he's gone, who? You know, and then all of a sudden he's scrambling, can somebody get some clips of this guy? And I know stories where that has actually happened in football before. I've seen that actually happen. So did he really spend it? Did he have much choice in the route the club were going down? Because a lot of these wealthy owners that own football clubs now, they don't want to hand it over to a manager or a director of football that they don't know. A lot of them come with their own directors of football that put their plan in place and the manager has to deal with it. And Dean Smith's job basically is put out fires. But you can watch Villa today. They're very, very passive. Even in the last 10 minutes, there wasn't a whole lot in what they did. They never really pinned Chelsea in. You know, normally when you're 2-0 down at home, and you can blame the crowd for this if you want, but you're 2-0 down, 2-1 down at home with 5 minutes to go, could take the shackles off and really pin Chelsea in. It never came, which just lets me know that psychologically, they I don't want to say they rolled over, but in a sense they kind of did. They just accepted the 2-1 defeat, really. And at one point there, Chelsea had 7, 8, 9, 10 passes in the corner. And no Villa player stuck a leg in or fouled or did anything, you know. They just kind of let the, you know, we're 2-1 down 10 minutes ago, I will accept this one and move on. And they're traits of a team that get relegated, you know. At least if they had a go and they just, you know, said, oh, I'm not having this really, I'm going to go and nail someone here, win the ball back and really try and pin Chelsea in. And maybe we'll get lucky, maybe we'll get a penalty, we'll get a deflection or something will happen. It never came because they never asked the questions, and that's why I would worry for Villa. The only thing is there two worst teams, because Norwich are gone, is there two worst teams?
Yeah.
I think West Ham possibly might be a bit softer than Villa. I think that Watford don't look like they're going in the great, so I think it's two from those three, really.
And Bournemouth Norwich maybe as well, because you throw in
well there you go, man. I mean they look like right in trouble as well. But again, if they stay up, it won't be with anything they've done. It'll just be there'll be two worst teams in them that were potentially softer. But looking at Villa today, pretty soft, they look wishy-washy, they don't have any real dogs in their team, they don't have any real, I don't use the term leaders, but you know, characters. You know, we're getting beat here, I'm not having this, and I'm just going to go and do something. Grealish had a little go at the end, but like, I mean, it just seemed to happen, and they let it happen, and it just fizzled out.
And as well, when you're in that situation, it's so important to have somebody who can score goals, and it just hasn't worked out for Villa like that. Wesley, as we know, is injured now, but he was struggling to find the net. They bring in Samata in January. I know he scored in his debut against Bournemouth, but he's gone now. He has 5 games now without a goal. I know it's a short amount of time, and he could still come good in the last 8 games now of the season, but that's such an important thing, isn't it? Having a goal scorer in these last few matches.
But they don't create any chances. So yeah, while it's important having a goal scorer, you've got to give them something. I mean, you know, Davis was on, and I know that they got Samata. But, they, you know, your wide players were playing as fullbacks today. It's very, very hard to create chances. It's very, very hard to give these guys something to feed off. It's hit and miss stuff because they're a nice, pretty team in their own half. You know, the midfield players like dropping and getting off the centre-backs and making great little passes in their own half, where it counts is in the Chelsea's defensive third. And they just don't do that for me. They just have a lack of cutting edge, a lack of character, a lack of personality in that team. And that's what happens when you bring together 10, 12 players who weren't there last year. You're trying to settle everybody in, and I just think that they're, you know, obviously a lot of money around that football club, and it just seems to be a bit wishy-washy for me.
You mentioned, if we go back to the top four battle and the impact this Chelsea result will have, and I know you might have your doubts over Manchester United. They did have a good run before the break. The break probably came at the worst time for them. They just beaten City in the derby, which is a big, big result for them. But there's been a lot of talk about Paul Pogba coming back and perhaps the link up between himself and Fernandes. Can they, you know, prove to be a good partnership for United? Or is Fernandes the kind of player that he's the star man and Pogba could perhaps upset what he was doing before the break?
I don't think so. I think those two players will find a way to work together. Scoring goals is a problem for Manchester United. I think Martial gets away with it for me. I think he's lazy, he's immobile, he's very, very disinterested for large portions of the game. Even the other night I was watching him, very, very static. There's not a whole lot of creativity in the fullback area. Aaron Wan-Bissaka is a very, very good defender. Is he like Azpilicueta today, where he set up 2 goals, you know, causing all sorts of damage, and Marcus Alonso as well with his 25-30 crosses? I'm not sure Luke Shaw is either on the other side. Decent players, don't get me wrong, but is there enough creativity there is enough creativity with Fernandes and Pogba, but is there enough people to get on the end of it, and is there enough people to score the goals that they're going to require? Because I almost feel like United will concede goals. So is there enough, you know, for them to get two or three goals a game? I don't think they're that type of team, and they're not set up for 1-0 wins. So they kind of have a lot of attacking players, but I just don't see them getting two or three goals a game.
So it looks like, you know, the top three is sewn up. City, Liverpool and Leicester City, you would have to say, probably have that other spot sealed off. Although you never know, there's still a small gap between them and Chelsea. But if you were looking at it that way, like, who else can you see getting into the top four apart from Liverpool and City? Is it Chelsea definitely going to get
them? I think Chelsea will sew up that fourth spot. But I think if there was a challenger to come for it, it'll probably come from Wolves.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's... Everyone's focusing on United, Spurs, Arsenal, you know, and there's a lot of like negativity as, oh, which one of them's going to get the fourth spot? I think it could be Wolves. If there's any team could put a run together, I think it's them, where they could put pressure on Chelsea. I don't think they've got enough to catch them, because I think Chelsea will win enough games and keep that cushion that they already have. But I know Man City have their problems with UEFA, so there could be a fifth spot available.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So if City do get thrown out of Europe, I mean, I think Wolves could get that fifth spot.
And they seem to be, Wolves are one of the more complete teams out of those teams. They've got really solid defence, good goalkeeper in Patricio, good midfield, and up front they've got an array of talent, the likes of Jota, Jimenez, of course, and Adama Traore.
A well-oiled machine. He has his principles, he has his way, how he wants to attack, how he wants to defend. And you could see straight away the game they played, they just picked it up straight away. You know, they're very, very well drilled. There's nothing probably left to chance, or nothing off the cuff for them. He's very well organised, very diligent, and I think he expects the same of his players.
And to finish, just your general thoughts on what we've seen so far this weekend, the Premier League coming back. Like, I know it's tough not having the crowds there, and it's hard for the supporters who support their team right through the season not to be able to be there. Maybe the Bundesliga kind of set us up for it well. I find I'm getting used to it a bit more.
Yeah.
What's your own thoughts on how it's gone?
It has to finish, just from a financial point of view, and I don't think anyone really cares of how it finishes, because Liverpool are going to be champions, so it just needs to finish, and we all just need to stop complaining and just July the 15th, it's less than a month, get the games out of the way and we start again next season. But I wouldn't look too much into this weekend, to be honest with you. You know, it is like first game of the season, and in my experience, first game of the season, very, very rarely two or three games in is usually the same team that's playing, or results, you know, pick up, you know, because players have had such a long time off. Some teams might have got their fitness regimes wrong and they might get to work on certain things. I don't know. But let's just all get behind it, get it over the line and start again next year.
That is Damien Delaney talking to Stephen Doyle after their commentary of Aston Villa 1, Chelsea 2, which we brought you live on yesterday's Off the Ball. Loads more big games coming up on Off the Ball over the coming days and weeks. On Wednesday, it's Anfield for Liverpool against Crystal Palace. Myself and Brian Carroll bring you that one. And then on Thursday, it is Chelsea against Manchester City. I'll be along Stephen Kelly for that game. Both of them getting underway at 8:15. The best place to listen to them and the easiest place to listen to them is on the OTB Sports app, which you can download right now in the App Store or in the Play Store. Just say OTB Sports app and search for that and you'll get it. So Manchester City tonight leading Burnley by 5-0. It was 3-0 at halftime. One for Phil Foden and two from Riyad Mahrez. In the second half, Foden has added his second. David Silva also on the score sheet. Means Manchester City will be within 20 points of Liverpool. So Liverpool can't win the title on Wednesday night. And it means more or less that it's going to go down to the wire. It'll go down to the Etihad on Thursday week when Liverpool travel there. That's another game that we'll bring you live here on Off the Ball. But City looking very, very impressive once again.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.